Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of May. Our guest this hour wrote a very extensive paper delivered at the Duke Conference on Nonprofit Media titled A Nonprofit Model for the New York Times. She asks a number of questions and says that there are a number of different proposals that the New York Times may want to consider. For that matter, so may other newspapers in the country, but this is the paper of record. Perhaps establishment of an endowment that would provide funds to support the Times News Department's annual $200 million budget. Foundational support for some of the Times' journalistic endeavors, perhaps its foreign or cultural coverage. Purchase of the Times by an educational institution or university. Or sale of the Times to an angel investor. We'll be looking at this paper of record in this country, what its financial situation is right now, and if one of those models may serve the Times well for its future success and viability. Our guest is Penelope Muse Abernathy, the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Penny. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or the email address is talk@WPR.org. Hello, Penny. Thank you so much for being with us. Oh, I'm sorry. We got you on ISDN today. There we go. Hi, Penny. How are you?
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us. I forgot where you were. Tell me first about what the financial story is with the New York Times. Are they in trouble financially?
Well, I think the New York Times is suffering a lot of the same woes that many newspapers are suffering, and then it's got some unique woes that are unique to the New York Times. And my purpose in writing the paper was first to explore a number of not-for-profit models that have been proposed by several institutions and folks who would like to see the Times survive and thrive in the 21st century and continue to be the national treasure it has been for the last 100 or so years, but also to lay out exactly what the roadmap might be for that and how it might not be as easy a path as some might have thought it would be. So your question was, what are the financial issues for the Times? It has a number of pluses that are unique to the Times. It has an incredible revenue stream for the print edition of the New York Times that many of its peers and Wall Street admire or maybe even envy. But on the downside, it has a number of liabilities that are unique to the Times, including heavy cost structure. Many of the costs are fixed, as well as a heavy debt right now.
I was interested in how much of the cost came from their foreign reporting, which could be endowed perhaps, but a lot of money goes into that part of the operation, doesn't it?
It does indeed. But, you know, many tend to focus first and foremost on the cost for the newsroom. And many of the initial impulses for trying to look at a not-for-profit model of the Times had to do with saving the newsroom cost. And one of the first points I wanted to make was that part of the issue for the New York Times on its cost side is borne only partially by the New York Times newsroom. The real issue for the Times is as we're changing to a digital model for distribution for just about every news organization, whether you're newspaper, magazine, or television right now, you're still carrying heavy, heavy legacy costs that come from basically the 19th century when we had the establishment of presses that could print off thousands of copies an hour. So if you think about it, even a daily newspaper is a successor to that 19th century notion of when is the deadline going to be so we can get hundreds of thousands of copies out to people. And if you change to a digital model, how do you continue to invest in the digital side while still maintaining the cost structure that you need to continue to deliver to people who expect to get a printed newspaper every day?
You talk about, and I wasn't aware of this in your paper, circulation for the Times in 2008. Most papers going down pretty significantly. The Times circulation went up.
Actually, in 2008, I think the Times circulation has actually, over a period of 10 years, decreased about 15% from a high. The issue is the Times has about 20 million readers who go to nytimes.com every day, and they pay absolutely nothing for that. Part of the issue with the Times is that, and one of the benefits the Times has had, is that it has been able to charge more than any other newspaper I'm aware of for a daily subscription. If you're living out of sight of New York, you pay somewhere between $600 and $700 a year for a print version of the New York Times on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. That is about four times what even the closest rival, the Wall Street Journal, would charge for a print edition. And so part of the issue is they've been able to continue to grow their circulation revenues, but even as their circulation of the print edition has declined, but have not been able so far to come up with a model in the digital world where they charge for that and use some of that money to offset the cost of news production.
Right. I'm one of those people who gets the Times, and it seems like, you know, you say how much money it is. I remember that once a year, how much money it is. It is a lot of money, but I couldn't live without the newspaper. I just couldn't live without it. I got problems with it, but it does things better than just about any other newspaper.
Oh, absolutely, and I have to tell you, I'm a long-time at least adult life subscriber to the New York Times. I also worked at the New York Times for 13 years, was on the masthead of the New York Times, and worked on the business side. So I fervently and passionately believe in it. And like you, I can't start the day without the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. When you talk in your paper here, they have 20 million visitors a month at NewYorkTimes.com remaining free to non-subscribers. If you've been free for so long, how can you become not free? I mean, is one of the viabilities to have to pay for that service online or not?
Well, I think that that is certainly something they've indicated they're willing to begin looking at. They've tried it a couple of years ago when they went with charging for the several of the op-ed, more popular op-ed columnists through Time Select. I think if you can compare and contrast to the Wall Street Journal, where I also worked and was on the masthead of the Wall Street Journal, many folks like to say, well, yes, but people will pay for business news, but they won't pay for general interest. I don't know, Kathleen. I think you and I may be more typical in that I would certainly be willing to pay for if it meant the survival of the New York Times, I would be certainly willing to pay at least what I pay to get Wall Street Journal or WSJ.com a year, which is about $119 a year, to access it on the New York Times, especially for the proprietary news that they do in foreign, national politics, culture, Science Times. You can tick off seven or eight categories where you might be willing to say, this is something the New York Times does uniquely or better than anyone else, and that if I face the loss of not having that or paying for it, I'd be more than willing to pay.
Right. Well, then you've got all these other unique parts of the paper, the Sunday magazine, the book review, which I'm sure is not inexpensive to produce.
Right.
You've got the Week in Review. You've got their science sections, which are very important. It seems to me as though those don't lend themselves to online at all. Maybe they do. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how – one of the things that I've been setting up a curriculum here that has basically forced me to go back and look at the economics of various media as they have made the transition. So, you know, you initially have books and you have newspapers, you have magazines, you have television, then you have online. And, of course, with the entrance of everyone, someone has always spelled doom and gloom for each one. What actually happens is that the media, the older traditional media, makes some adjustment. So I always say I'm very bullish on the future of newspapers. It's just that we're going through a rough patch. The economist Joseph Schumpeter back in the 1930s called this creative destruction, and it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition of two words, creation and destruction, and I think he did it very deliberately. What we're seeing right now is the destruction of the traditional business models that have sustained mm-hmm. traditional media, but we're seeing creations of new ones. And the ones that navigate this very tricky divide are the ones that survive and thrive. And I think with the New York Times, the other thing that you also see as a medium matures like cable, like television, for instance, you see a lot of new mechanisms arise in which you can charge for things that you couldn't charge for before. And cable television is a classic example.
Yeah. And yet, there were, when you use that word mature, some people would say what's happened in local television and what's happened with a lot of cable is that they haven't matured. We have much less foreign reporting. We don't have the quality of journalism. We have a lot of talking heads. Has it matured at all, or has the quality become immature?
Well, I think you hit on the essential notion of why folks are so perturbed about what would happen if we woke up tomorrow and there was no New York Times. If you look at it from an economist's perspective, what happens is that most of the news that you see on television or is quoted on cable news, a large majority of it comes whether you're looking at a local television station or you're looking at the national networks or a cable network. A large majority of it is produced by the newspapers that we know and love today.
Right.
And if those were not to exist, where would the news come from? You're depending much more on a citizen journalism and going back to a very different era of what we've come to expect for credibility, objectivity, and a whole range of things in terms of our news reporting.
Yeah. Before we talk about all of your models that you present in your paper that would preserve and protect the unique form of journalism we get from the Times and the watchdog role in the 21st century, you can't underestimate the incredible importance of the watchdog role or overestimate that. I'm sure you saw Frank Rich's piece yesterday, and I want to quote something that he said here because it's behind whether or not we have the will to do anything about all of this. Nobody knows, he writes, what form journalism will take in the evolving post-newspaper era. Just because information wants to be free on the internet doesn't mean it can always be free. Web advertising will never be profitable enough to support ambitious news gathering. If a public that thinks nothing of spending money on texting or pornography doesn't foot the bill for such reporting, it won't happen. Do you want to pony up for news, whatever the media that prevail, or not? Do we want to pony up for that or not? What do you think?
You're asking me,
yeah,
right, for my response. First off, let me I worked with Frank for a number of years and have a tremendous deal of respect for his views. I would say that the one quibble I would have with Frank, and I hear this often from journalists of our age and of our generation, and I make this point having taught now for the last year a digital media economics course here at UNC, the students who are coming through give me great hope for the future. They're all, almost all to a T, entrepreneurs. They tend to focus on the creation aspect of creative destruction. We tend to see what will be lost.
And I think
when you make blanket statements that web advertising will never support, that is something we don't know. When I hear editors say advertising has gone away for good, the truth of the matter is if you look at economics for any period of time, it will appear somewhere else. The real question is, will newspapers be the beneficiary of where that advertising appears?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Interesting response. All right, let's look at some of these models that would preserve and protect the Times' unique journalism and watchdog role in the 21st century. Establishment of an endowment.
Right. This was first suggested by David Swenson and Michael Smith in an op-ed piece in the New York Times on January 28th, and they basically proposed establishing a $5 billion endowment that would support the $200 million cost of the newsroom. They acknowledge there might be some limitations with that. One of those is, of course, you would not be able to politically endorse folks. You might conceivably be able to weigh in on perhaps political issues, but not to actually endorse political candidates. There are a couple of issues with that, and one of them has to do with the Yale Endowment itself, which suffered a 25% decline this past year. So obviously, if you are taking from an endowment 5% a year, which is roughly what you would need to sustain the newsroom, and you have a 25% endowment, then you're still going to have to – you might protect the newsroom from shareholders who might want to cut back or from advertisers' whims, but you're not going to protect them from the macroeconomic loss. And then the second one is, given the valuation of the Times stock right now, it looks as if it could, if they were forced into bankruptcy or some other or if the family were even willing to sell, it looks as if it could be purchased for substantially less. And if you purchased it, you would be free to try to make some of the changes that are going to be necessary, such as looking at the huge legacy of printing and distribution cost, mm-hmm. which weigh down the Times even more than the news department, as I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what the situation is with the stock, Penny.
The stock has been running between $5 and $6. It was as high as $52, about, I think, 2 years ago. So most newspaper stocks have suffered dramatically, but the Times has suffered at least as much, if not more, than others.
Mm-hmm. Foundational support for some portion of their endeavor, maybe cultural or maybe foreign reporting.
Well, I thought this one was one of the more interesting ones, and it goes back to something very similar to NPR, where you would look at taking a certain portion that you might actually either endow or solicit funds to produce. They would, and as an example, I use the Council on Foreign Relations, which has roughly a $68 million budget a year, and it would be, I would say, roughly equivalent to what perhaps the foreign desk might be at the New York Times. And we looked at a number of ways of doing that. The council's supported by memberships and annual giving, by grants and fellowships, by book sales, meetings and rentals, and by funds derived from an endowment. And so if you, with all of that, the council has been able to thrive and provide a very important voice, I think, in foreign affairs. And it seemed to be a very good model to look at. There was another one we looked in a number of other ways, that one at Wisconsin that we can talk about in just a little bit, of an educational support for that.
Mm-hmm. I had no idea that the Council on Foreign Relations received $68 million in revenue. That's a lot of money.
Yes, it is indeed.
Yeah. Another one, purchase of the Times by an educational institution or university.
Well, there's a well-known example in newspapers of an educational institution that actually owns a newspaper. And one of the best-known examples is the St. Pete Times in St. Petersburg, Florida. But, you know, as folks at the conference at Duke pointed out last week, one of the issues is it works well for the St. Pete Times up to a point. It still has macroeconomic pressure similar to what an endowment would have. So if the St. Pete Times does not have money, they still have to or make as much money as they did previously, and they still have to go through some of the downsizing that others are having, or layoffs. But the other option is you just don't – they're not – that works well for the St. Pete Times. I'm not sure how well it can be duplicated. So what I did was draw on two different scenarios slightly from that, which is to look at, instead of creating a university-sized endowment of $5 billion or so to support the newsroom, suppose a university – purchased the New York Times, or maybe a consortium of universities purchased the New York Times. Now, from that, I drew on the Harvard Business School publishing example, which is where I worked for several years. It is owned by the Harvard Business School and actually publishes the Harvard Business Review, among other things, as well as books, newsletters, and a whole different case studies and a whole range of online activities. That has been consistently a nice source of revenue for the business school. It's enabled the business school to make a large number of expansions it would not have been able to otherwise. That, along with its executive education program, differentiate the Harvard Business School and the sources of revenue it has from a lot of other business schools. The issue with that, though, is that there's a very different size of scale. I mean, with the New York Times, you're talking about revenues last year of the New York Times newspaper alone of almost $2 billion, and which the Harvard Business School publishing is a small fraction of that. So that was one model. The other one I looked at was something called WARF, which I think is short for Warfarin, which is the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation that owns the patents for University of Wisconsin Research and returns the money from the patents as well as from gifts from alumni back to the university for research. And so the question was, could you come up with some similar model for the New York Times to fund its research, even if it were for both the newsroom or even in a foreign desk reporting arrangements like that. I think the real issue there, Kathleen, is that, again, if you're a university and you're looking at buying this, due diligence says you need to be able to determine that the New York Times is not going to be a cash drain on other investments the university could make. And the problem right now is, with as long as they continue to have the high cost structure that they have because of the printing and distribution costs, and have declining revenues, advertising revenues, which they've suffered for the last 2 years, that you at some point cross the line and dip from being in the black into the red. And unless you can get in and totally overhaul the cost structure and also migrate to an online revenue model that's profitable, it's going to take a lot of management bandwidth by university to help the Times transition.
There's another model we'll get to in a moment. We have a number of people who'd like to speak with you, Penny. That model, of course, would be some angel investor who you could sell the Times to, who would bring adequate compensation to the family who have owned the Times for such a long period of time, for 100 years. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to go that route, is talk@WPR.org. And our guest is Penelope Muse Abernathy, Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who presented a very interesting paper on the future of the New York Times and to look at different kinds of models for keeping the foreign reporting going, the science reporting, all of that. Obviously, it's a paper of record for the United States, and it would be hard to see that paper go. But what form does it take? And what is it financially viable for the future of the New York Times? Okay, to your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest presented her paper, A Nonprofit Model for the New York Times, at the Duke Conference on Nonprofit Media, which took place last week. We go to phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Jim from Green Bay is our first caller. Penny, hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I understand this is about nonprofit models, but I'm intensely interested in what I'm hearing. But I'm just wondering about the guest's perspective on a commercial model, which is, I think the online world is very, very young, and different ways of making money haven't really been worked out. And I keep imagining that the premium content providers like Reuters and the New York Times and McClatchy and the Christian Science Monitor, I keep imagining they'll at some point band together and establish a fee to access all their content, which will be available around the world. And I'm just wondering what the guests might think about that.
Well, I think, Jim, that definitely, as I mentioned before, I think as models mature, you have a whole range of new revenue models that are available to you. I was interested this morning to see a piece in the Financial Times saying that the Wall Street Journal, in addition to charging more for a premium subscription online, is also looking to do micropayments. I think you're going to see a whole range of options tried over the next year. And I would say that for the New York Times, even if you talk with the analysts that follow the New York Times, there was an interesting quote I had in my paper from Mike Symington at Fitch Ratings, who said he has every confidence that the New York Times as a product, now that means he needs the New York Times newspaper itself, should survive commercially because it has a very attractive audience for advertisers and it has very loyal readers. Probably, most likely, as the New York Times tries to pay off the $1 billion in debt it now has, the New York Times Company, which includes the Boston Globe, it includes an equity interest in the Red Sox, it includes about 18 newspapers in the South and New England, they will probably not be part of the New York Times Company, in part because those might have to be sold off to pay the debt.
Okay, so, excuse me, if I could just butt in. I guess my question really is, can you imagine or foresee some banding together to form a consortium? Because you're just talking about the New York Times, and I'm thinking about all the news organizations that are all going to have trouble if they can't get paid for their online presence.
No, I certainly the Associated Press has taken that one on in the last couple of months, too, trying to think of a consortium that would. And I think the real issue is a sense that Google primarily has benefited from piggybacking on the content that they haven't had to pay for. So I think that the trick is going to be, what is the content that they provide uniquely or better than anyone else? Because I do think in a digital age, there is a lot of news that's out there that becomes a commodity. So the real key will be for McClatchy or with Christian Science Monitor of the New York Times, what do they provide in a proprietary sense that is either unique or they provide better than anyone else that people would be willing to pay for?
Well I hear you, but you're still not addressing the consortium question. I feel like all the news... It's not like you break out the New York Times and say they're separate and they have to stand alone and be able to be paid for what they do. Can't they band together with all the good providers? That's kind of my question.
Well, I mean, you've had consortiums of news organizations for more than 100 years, and as I mentioned, the Associated Press is trying to do that with all of its member newspapers, which the New York Times is a member of. I think there are going to be different solutions in different markets, and as I said, I think in the McClatchy markets, what, for instance, the Raleigh News and Observer or the Charlotte Observer, who are right in our backyard, provide, what the news that they provide uniquely or better than anyone else, whether it's ACC sports coverage, whether it's North Carolina politics, I still think there is a value, and they will evolve into a model which perhaps loyal readers will be willing to pay for.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. John is from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Well, your guest this morning evoked the rather tragic memory of Joseph Schumpeter and creative destruction, and those of us in the North here, especially unionized workers, when we hear creative destruction, we just substitute the word union busting. And the thing is that these entities, nobody cried for us, the 600,000 factory workers who have lost our jobs since the end of World War II. In fact, many of these papers that want to be saved now editorialized against workers in the 1980s. And the reality is that we had a fantastic newspaper here in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Leader, that went out of business in 1939, perhaps the best paper in the United States. And the New York Herald Tribune, which I believe went out of business in 1965. And this is just capitalism. It is just pure, raw capitalism. And until we change our economic sense in this country, these things are going to happen.
So what kind of model would you be looking at, John, to save newspapers?
I don't think, given the economic model, they can be saved.
Penny.
Well, I think that what John is saying is what prompted, I think, the beginning of the proposals coming from David Swenson at Yale is there a way to help newspapers transition during this difficult time? And I would have to say John is right, at least in that Joseph Schumpeter saw creative destruction as capitalism's way of reshuffling the deck. Now, unlike John, he took a more of a pro-capitalist free market approach, which is that had been the genius of the entrepreneurial spirit, which is whenever you have a company that is making a lot of profits, a lot of entrepreneurs look into that space and see, gee, could I do that more less expensively and get to market with a better product and build on what has come before? And I think the real question, what separates the newspapers from other industries, and is not that great a divide. I mean, you've heard similar arguments for the automotive industry on why it needs to be saved and why creative destruction ultimately hurts us when our industrial production. I think the issue with newspapers on helping them get across this this digital divide and through this period of destruction is the issue of how important is that to us as a democracy and to the watchdog role that we perform.
Mm-hmm. And that is a vital question. It is so linked with the function of a democracy, with a watchdog purpose of the newspapers. I mean, it's hard to imagine that role not being fulfilled by anybody. What would happen to government? What would happen to a whole democracy? I don't want to overstate this, but but I will. Don't you think?
Well, I think, Kathleen, that you have to go back to 1776 or even to the 1790s with the foundation of the Constitution. I mean, we do have we are the First Amendment. We are guaranteed freedom of the press. But the press that was guaranteed at that point was a smaller press. It was a much more partisanship. It had a variety of pamphleteers. And, you know, we may be looking at something, a return to that. We really have only had mass communication since, I would say, the early 19th century and maybe 1810 is usually when I date it with the when you have the Times of London coming out with a press that's able to actually, I think, produce a grand total of 10,000 copies an hour. But you really needed a combination of the presses that could distribute to a large variety of people, and you needed the advertising, which has supported it. Most newspapers have lived on 80% of the advertising, and all of the profits have come from the advertising. And that's what makes what we're living through right now. We're living through both a period of creative destruction and the worst advertising recession since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a double whammy for newspapers, whether you're the New York Times or whether you're the Milwaukee Journal right now.
Right. We haven't talked about the fourth area, and that's the sale of the Times to an angel investor. What would be the possibility of that? How many angel investors are there?
Well, you know, one of the things I looked at in terms of looking at how reasonable was it to look at someone to set up an endowment was to look at the most recent list from Forbes of the 35 or so wealthiest individuals. And as you look at that, there are not a lot of people, single people, who have the wherewithal either to set up the endowment or to actually come through and be an angel for the New York Times. Two names that pop up repeatedly are Carlos Slim, who's the Mexican entrepreneur who has invested in the Times recently and also lent them $250 million to make a major debt payment that was coming due this month, and Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. Now, Bloomberg has repeatedly said he's not interested in a newspaper, but unlike some of his cohorts, has not flat out and definitively said he could never envision owning the New York Times. Carlos Slim, his $250 million in debt that he is holding entitles him to convert to preferred shares in the New York Times, which would give him an ownership that's almost equal to the Sulzberger family. So he would presumably, even though he doesn't have the same power to vote those shares as the Sulzbergers do, if there were some precipitating instance such as the Times having a liquidity issue and not being able to make its next round of debt payments, he would presumably be in a great position to weigh in on what he would prefer for the Times. And I think the real question is would that person want to incorporate the Times as a low-profit, limited liability corporation that's called an L3C, which is gaining some momentum in Congress. It's been introduced by a senator from Maryland that would make newspapers eligible for this, or would he prefer to maximize profit? And I think it gets back to the question of what do you see is the business future for the New York Times? Will it be able to amass enough loyal readers who are willing to pay for it in a digital age, or pay for it if it's transmitted digitally? Will it be able to reconstitute this incredible advertising model that has sustained them over the last 50 years in a digital age? And will it be able to also manage the cost side right, effectively? And that's really where you come down is if you can see a future for the New York Times in which it thrives financially, you would want to stay with a for-profit model.
Mm-hmm. Bill is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I want to a fascinating subject and one that I think is politically scarier than the economics in some regards, and that is having an independent voice. It's funny you should mention David Swensen at Yale. Yale also has one of the finest law schools teaching constitutional law, the finest programs in that of our former president. God, I just blanked on his name. How could I? Bubba, there we are. Went there, and Hillary Clinton also. Oh, that's right, President Clinton. Anyway, pardon me. The point being that I've been an owner of a newspaper here in Wisconsin, part owner, and own some very small newspapers, and I'm very sensitive to the fact that you can only be as tough and independent as you want to be if you have financial backing or an advertising base to do that. And my sense is that to be tough and to be critical, if the university, if the, a consortium of universities or whatever owned the Times, I'm not sure they'd have the moxie or the guts to really take tough political stands. And I say that out of personal experience. Of a university that has been mentioned phoned up the New Republic and tried to squash an article by a relative of mine that was critical of the university's handling of overseas artifacts. Now, that's totally against, I think it's probably even illegal. It's totally against any moral sense of what a newspaper is about. I mean, yes, newspapers do withhold information requested by government sometimes, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes, as we've learned, that's extremely very dangerous in terms of how political terms can go, and that is, you know, squashing information perhaps from Iraq or Vietnam that's unfavorable, or blocking out reporters. But the institution itself, I think you have to figure out how is it going to be independent and how is it going to keep itself independent under the kind of political pressures that will be brought to bear on it if it's a really tough newspaper. Anyway, that's my comment.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, that's it. That's good. Thanks for the call. Penny.
I think Bill raises an excellent point about any of the non-for-profit models. Swenson mentioned right off the bat the notion of not being able to make political endorsements, but there is a sensitivity, whether you operate in the for-profit or the not-for-profit world, about how independent you are. And as Bill points out, one of the advantages for both the New York Times as well as for small papers that have done quite well has been that the advertising has enabled them to erect, if you will, a wall between the editorial side and the advertising side, and they've been profitable enough to say to advertisers, these are the things that you cannot, these are the areas of the wall you cannot breach. The at least the more credible newspapers have done that. And, you know, one of the issues when you're in a non-for-profit role is that you are subject to the grants that you receive. So whether you're in a university looking at the world a very different way than the way newspapers have looked at themselves, at least in the 20th century, in terms of providing credible and objective reporting, it's you will find that not just in a university, but I think with any of the foundations that might be looking to make grants, too.
Our number is 800-486-8655. We have a couple lines open now. They've been quite busy. And our email is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to an email. Penny, The Guardian in London essentially owns itself. It's a trust and makes money on its website in the United States. Is that a model?
Well, I think there are going to be many models, and that's the people often ask me, when is someone going to come up with an answer? And my response is, there won't be one answer. There will be many answers, and it will depend on the market. It will depend on the newspaper. I mentioned in the beginning the St. Pete Times, and that's a classic example of one that has worked quite well for the St. Pete Times and for the Poynter Institute down in Florida until relatively recently, and probably will continue to work for them into the 21st century, just as The Guardian has happened on its own model, too, that works for them right now. It's, I think both are the St. Pete Times and The Guardian are excellent newspapers. I enjoy reading both. I traveled a good deal in my role as the Wall Street Journal, with the Wall Street Journal, and was always glad to read The Guardian, just as I've always, since the early 70s, looked forward to reading the St. Pete Times. So I think it will depend on the newspaper, on the ownership, and of how it evolves. And I certainly think there you could conceive a model for the New York Times in which it might be part not-for-profit or for-profit. I think the it's impossible to know at the moment what's going to work best for them during this time when we just look out at destruction. But I think that The Guardian is definitely an issue that is an example of one that has worked for them.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Penelope Muse Abernathy, Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And she has written a very interesting paper, which was presented at the Duke Conference on Nonprofit Media last week. And it's titled A Nonprofit Model for the New York Times. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to your phone calls now. Jim is next from Anniston. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Well, we've heard a lot about advertising and about how to get enough money to run newspapers, and we heard about the watchdog role of the newspapers. And I feel that we've been leaving out the news role. And the news role is that the newspapers of this country let this country down in a most staggeringly tremendous way, not just about Iraq, but about this financial meltdown. They were all on the take. They all had big business sections. They wanted to keep them going. They just didn't have the public in mind, and that's why they're being deserted. Why is it that during the certainly the earlier part of the Iraq War, intelligent people were listening to the BBC or reading The Guardian instead of reading The New York Times, because The New York Times didn't have useful stuff except on page 97. So that's the problem. They've got to go back to making news if they expect to sell a newspaper. They want to sell an advertising sheet. Well, that's fine. You know, there's lots of people want to buy $200,000 watches, and they got to figure out how to get them an advertising sheet. But they have failed their news-gathering ability. Until they get back to that, nobody's going to be interested in them.
Penny.
Well, I think that you can. I think it really gets back to what you perceive as the role of newspapers, and I think all of us can point to examples where we, in hindsight, and we look at it with 2020, say we wish newspapers had done better. I think the New York Times has certainly done a lot of soul searching over a lot of the early coverage they did, especially of the Iraq War and of weapons of mass destruction coverage. As for the financial meltdown, I think you could look and see a number of stories that were done. They perhaps didn't get the ink that they should have been done, but I think there's always going to be a notion that we could have done better, and I hope that part of the soul searching for this does come to the notion. I don't think you've seen a lack of coverage of the financial meltdown from people being diverted by advertising or by commercial interest. I think it was more a notion of this was a new and different thing that seemed to have the endorsement of the folks highest up in the two previous administrations. So it was much easier to think that we were, in fact, even as Alan Greenspan was quoted on a number of occasions saying, proposing, that we were on to something new and different. So I think you're always going to find quarrels with the way things were covered, especially in hindsight, and say, I wish someone had been on top of this. I think the issue is, where do you look for that coverage? And I mean, if the New York Times were to not be 20 years from now, who would be stepping in to provide that? If the Wall Street Journal didn't exist 20 years from now, who would be stepping in to provide the insight that comes from all that?
Mm-hmm. I think I could try and tell you. Try Democracy Now. It's an hour-long news program, been going for almost 20 years. It's a slight exaggeration. I guess 13 years. All their previous stuff is online. You can read it. The quality and basically their news is 6 months ahead of yours. They have mm-hmm. people talking about the problems, which then show up 6 months later. Now, if they can do it on a shoestring budget, you could do it too.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to an email here. One idea I have for newspapers to create stronger ties with academic institutions, not journalism schools, which I think are contributing to problems. Providing opportunities for reporters with direct experience of relevant topics to share their knowledge with students. A university might be interested in having someone who served as a foreign correspondent to be a visiting scholar for a month or two in an international affairs program, or a school district could pay for someone who covers local or state government to go into the classroom and share what they know with students several times during the year. What do you think of that, Penny?
Well, I think it already occurs in a number of places. Certainly, if you look at the weekly calendar for who's coming to the to speak at UNC, there are any number of journalists, foreign correspondents that come in, and not just into the journalism school, but into a whole range of schools, whether it's international studies or politics or whatever we're looking at. So I think that it already exists, and in many cases, foreign correspondents do this as on a volunteer basis because they feel so strongly about the mission of what they accomplish. I'm not sure what the what else we're talking about with institutions becoming more involved. I think if you're looking at a not-for-profit model, I think, again, to get back to the notion of how the Council on Foreign Relations has set itself up to be an alternative source for foreign reporting might be an example of something maybe universities might look to if there is if something like that is missing in a certain area that's vitally important to us in a watchdog role.
Wayne from Holman is next. Hi, Wayne.
How about those Brewers, Kathleen?
Hey, how about those Brewers?
Hey,
no.
We can agree on something, can't we? I love you, girl. Say, to your guest, you know, oh, she is a brilliant young woman, but I have to disagree. If she goes along with the last caller's viewpoint that news agencies need to make the news, no, they don't. They need to objectively report the news, current events as they occur, absent their political bias, whichever it is, right or left, as far as a newspaper is concerned, and then let us be the judge of the accuracy or inaccuracy of the report and other agencies, news agencies we hear from. I don't know if you agree or disagree with me, but I think sometimes with the New York Times, they may have lost readership because, from a conservative viewpoint, they come more often than not on the side of the left, and I'm probably wrong, and you'll correct me if I am, but that's how I see it. I don't read the Times a lot. I get it on occasion, but maybe you disagree, and I'd like to hear your viewpoint. And with all due respect, I appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you, Wayne, for the call. Penny.
Thank you, Wayne. Let me just clarify one thing. I was not advocating in any way that newspapers needed to make news. I still am traditional enough to think they need to report it. I think you're always going to have a lively and debate on whether news is reported objectively as it should be, and I think it's going to depend on your own political prism through which you look. There are some who prefer the reporting of the Wall Street Journal, for instance, to the New York Times because they see it as much more objective. There are others who think the New York Times is much more objective in the way it reports on many of those things. So I think you raise a valid point that it's almost impossible, which is one of the first things you appreciate as a reporter, to write a totally objective report. You want to try to make it fair in both context as well as facts on what you're reporting. And the point I was making was I do think the Times has done a lot of good soul searching over things they may have missed initially in the beginning of the Iraqi conflict. And I also think that really good financial newspapers and news organizations have done a lot of soul searching as to whether they could have spotted the bubble that we've been in sooner than they did.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Wayne, for your call. Tom from Burlington, hello.
My sister goes to Harvard and for nothing. And they let her in the classroom because she says she asks such wonderful questions. And Tom Friedman comes up there a lot of times to the classrooms and sits there, so she knows him. But what I wanted to ask was, is the the watchdog question is, now with these webcams, you can put a webcam right into a little local town hall meeting and you can broadcast it throughout the world. And I think that's one of the trends that might solve that problem. The question I wanted to ask was, I have two more. The question I wanted to ask was: is the debt that they acquired to build up to buy these other newspapers, is that the reason that the New York Times is really in trouble? And the next question I want to ask you: there's a little bar right across the street from the New York Times. It's been there for 50 years, and I went there once, and I wonder if you went there too.
I'm not going to answer the last question first. Let me take a stab at the first question. In terms of the debt, the debt for the New York Times, I think the real issue for them is the debt was built up in a number of ways. They purchased the Boston Globe back in 93, but that's long since been paid for. The real question for the real issue for the New York Times is they basically sold the magazine and the television stations, and instead of making major purchases that might have diversified or helped them make that digital divide, the only successful purchase they made, and successful in terms of that it hasn't turned out to be a bad investment for them, has been About.com, which they did in, I think, 2005 or thereabouts. But the issue is they're just so heavily dependent. They're roughly 95% of their profits come either from the web or from the print versions of the newspaper, unlike, in contrast, for instance, the Washington Post, which purchased Kaplan Inc. back in the 20 years ago or so, and that has served as a real growth engine as the revenues have declined for the newspapers. Is that the question you would ask?
Yeah, and that's going to have to be the question and the final word on it because we are out of time. Penny, thank you so much for being with us. Can people download this article, this paper somewhere?
Yes, indeed. It's, I think, on the Romanesco website at pointer.org, and it was also going to be up on the Duke website soon.
It's on our website, too. I've just found
good,
it.
Great. Yeah,
so
good.
We'll thanks. Send people there. Thank you so much for being with us. Penelope Muse Abernathy, Knight Chair, Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And you can get a copy of her extensive paper, A Nonprofit Model for the New York Times, at our website, which is WPR.org. Well, that was interesting. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour and to Rob as well for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11 talking about big stories and interesting issues, as you will hear all day long here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute now before 11, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.